Hello, Auditor Usmani. Welcome to the Glenn Show.
Hi, Glenn.
I probably should say Adonir Usmani. Is that right?
I told you it's an invented name. You can mispronounce it however you'd like.
This is Glenn Lowry, Brown University, the Glenn Show at bloggingheads.tv, and I am indeed with Adonir Usmani, who is a PhD in sociology from New York University and a postdoctoral fellow in the first of a two-year postdoctoral fellowship, just completing the first year here at Brown University. And we are here to talk about the issue of incarceration in the United States, which is a subject that Adonir is a scholar and done research on, and something that I've written about and been concerned about here at the Glenn Show for some time. So welcome.
Thank you. Thanks very much. Thanks a lot for having me.
Tell us a little bit about what you do in your research work that bears on this theme or that doesn't bear on this theme. I think, you know, people should know a little bit about who you are and what you do.
Sure. So I my dissertation is actually quite unrelated to the issue of mass incarceration. My dissertation is about the rise and fall of labor movements in the advanced capitalist world over the course of the 20th century. I came to the issue of incarceration really through reading Michelle Alexander's book, The New Jim Crow, and then the debate that was started by James Forman when he wrote a criticism of that book in the NYU Law Review, I believe, in 2012.
Yeah.
So a collaborator and I wrote a paper trying to assess that debate generally, drawing on general evidence across the United States. So roughly that debate, James Forman started by noting that in, you know, even though Michelle Alexander's narrative of the rise of incarceration fixates on the Southern strategy and the reaction of the white electorate and white elites in particular to the civil rights movement and the gains of the civil rights movement, James Forman Jr. noted that in a majority black area governed by a majority black political class, namely Washington, D.C., there were outlying incarceration rates and outlying levels of police surveillance and police brutality and what have you. And so he proposed in that piece, and then obviously later in the Pulitzer Prize winning book, that the racial politics of mass incarceration are actually significantly more complicated than the quote unquote conventional narrative allows. And my first paper on mass incarceration more or less supports that perspective, but draws on national data, not just DC specific data. I mean, there's another book by Michael Javen Fortner on Harlem, which also summons Harlem specific data to make that point. But we found general support for that position using national level data. And the kinds of data we looked at were national level public opinion polls from 1960 to the present. And we found that, yes, it's true, white public opinion trended punitive over the 60s, 70s, 80s, and 90s. But if the Michelle Alexander thesis were correct, you'd expect that only white public opinion trended punitively. But actually, you see similar trends in black public opinion, which suggests that people are reacting to the rise in violent crime and not just responding to the gains of the civil rights movement. And then we also found, kind of to our surprise, we also found that the proportion of black elected officials in state legislatures positively predicted the subsequent incarceration rate. And we also exploited an instance of federally mandated redistricting in the South to sort of get a natural experiment test of that effect. And we found that in these redistricted states in the South immediately after redistricting, you also saw a spike in incarceration, which we attributed to the influx of black elected officials. So all of this evidence led us to doubt the conventional narrative. And that's the first paper. Now I have a few other papers on incarceration in the works, but that was the first paper, my first.
Yeah, let me say a couple of things. I want anybody who's listening who doesn't know to know that James Forman is a professor at the Yale Law School. He was a Supreme Court clerk with Justice Sandra Day O'Connor. He served as a public defender in the District of Columbia's courts for some period of time. And he's written a book called Locking Up Our Own, which is a historical account of the role that African-American political and community leaders played in the punitive reaction to an upsurge in crime, especially drug-related crime, in the District of Columbia. So he won the Pulitzer Prize for that book in the most recent cycle, which ain't too shabby. He happens also to be a Brown alum, which we would not want to allow go without being stated.
And an ex-guest on this show?
He has indeed come on the Glenn Show, and he's also been a guest lecturer in the undergraduate course that I teach on race and inequality here at Brown, and I hope to have him back in the next cycle. But the research findings that you were describing, I've found to be quite interesting, going from the case study, if you will, of James Forman in the District of Columbia or Michael Fortner with respect to Harlem, in a similar historical period, documenting that there were increased demands for punitive reaction to the, depredations of criminal offending amongst African Americans in urban centers. Some of the stuff that you were saying sounded very interesting to me, and I didn't hear it the first time you told me. If you told me about this, you know, the natural experiment of looking at where redistricting did and didn't happen, so the redistricting under the Voting Rights Act is meant to carve out majority-minority districts, which can make it highly likely that African Americans would be elected, and finding that the fact of redistricting seemed to be associated with more punitive criminal justice policy, suggesting the influx of African American political voice is positively associated with the punitiveness of the state's policy. Finding too that across states, the higher representation of African Americans in the legislature was positively correlated with cross-state variation in the punitiveness of the state's policy. These are interesting things, and it does undermine the simple narrative, and I'll stop because you're the expert on this, that it was purely anti-black antipathy filtered through the voting behavior of white people and the reaction to that of white politicians that accounts for the rise in incarceration. So that's very interesting. I had thought one way that I want this to be a conversation about both the social causation and also about the social judgment. You know, we've experienced this phenomenon in the United States that has by now been much remarked upon of, you know, outsized growth in the extent that we rely on imprisoning people as a part of the broader array of social policies that are implemented to respond to social problems like disorder, crime, and violence. We in the United States are different from other countries. We're different from how we used to respond to these kinds of problems, which are not new in the past. Something seems to have happened in the late 60s and early 70s, and we're different in terms of the incidence of what we're doing in the incarceration area, how the burden of that is being borne by different communities in the country. And I wondered if I could get you in the next few minutes to offer your thoughts both about on all three of those fronts, all three of those differences. Why is the United States an outlier relative to other countries in the way in which we deal with lawbreaking? We're not the only place where there is a crime problem. Why is the United States so different than it had been in the earlier part of the 20th century, 40, 50, 60 years ago? And we see a radical shift. So we go from, I don't know, 120 per 100,000 in prison to 600, 700 per 100,000 under lock and key. We count those who are in jails as well. Why? And why is it that this thing that we're doing here in the United States in terms of using incarceration seems to fall so differentially across lines of race and class? So there you are. That's a full agenda. We could probably talk on for a long time about that, but what do you say?
Yeah, all weighty questions. I think maybe the easiest way into that discussion is to start with the longitudinal question, since that's the way that the question of the puzzle of mass incarceration is often posed, as okay. In what changed in the United States.
Yeah.
And this relates to what we were discussing earlier, which is that I think this is one of the points that James Forman makes, which I fully agree with. One of the issues with so much that's written about incarceration is that we write about incarceration without writing about crime and violence. And I think the biggest thing that changed in the United States between the 1950s and the 1980s and the 1990s was that there was a very, very significant rise in violent crime and specifically lethal violence. And that set the stage for the politics that followed. So that would be my first corrective to the quote unquote conventional narrative, which is that the rise in violence was central. Now, I think I probably depart from some of those people who emphasize the rise in violence in the following way, which is that I believe that the rise in violence mattered in that it filtered into public opinion and public punitiveness. And that's what I've seen and other people have documented in public opinion polls. But I don't think that the connection between the rise in public punitiveness and the rise in public policy is simple or straightforward. I do think that there are mediating factors that explain why public punitiveness became policy punitiveness. And the thing that I would fixate on in a sort of short summary of the argument is that I think that the United States in particular does not give its public policy tools to deal with violence in any way other really than police and prison. So if that makes sense, the point is basically that in the United States, policy options are severely constrained such that public punitiveness becomes police and prisons rather than any other sort of root cause assault on the root causes of social disorder or what we might call a social democratic response to crime. Those kinds of options are off the table in the United States, and so we get police and prisons. And one thing that I would emphasize in this that I don't think people emphasize enough, in fact, I don't think many people note this, maybe with the exception of John Pfaff in his very most recent book. I wish I could remember the name of that book. Locked In? Do you remember the name of that
book? No, I don't.
But the point that he makes that I would emphasize here is that police and prisons are actually remarkably cheap, inexpensive ways to deal with social disorder. I mean, the United States spends on the order of $250 billion a year on police and prisons today, which is not very much relative to the amount that it spends on social programs. And a counterfactual social democratic response to social disorder would have been much more expensive. But the truth is that the rise in crime happened at a moment in time that the federal government was not really ready or committed. I mean, in fact, there was a sort of turn to the right coincident with the rise in crime. And so those options were just off the table in the United States. I mean, they're often off the table for these conjunctural reasons. And they're also obviously off the table for longstanding reasons having to do with the weakness of social democratic traditions in the United States, et cetera, et cetera. So that would be my short answer to how I would explain what changed in the United States between the 1950s and the present. There was a rise in violence. There's punitiveness, but punitiveness only feeds policy punitiveness in the United States, but it need not have, I suppose, is what I'm trying to say.
Okay, let me just interject a couple of things because there's a lot on the table. I guess this, what you just said, could also speak to some degree to one of the other questions, which is why is the U.S. so different in the extent of incarceration compared to other industrialized democratic societies. But violence and the portfolio of policies as a politically practical matter that are available to respond. Violence stimulating a demand for punitiveness, the poverty of the policy agenda, explaining why that demand resulted in incarceration and not in, I don't know, better funds for education or early childhood, support to try to avert. I mean, I guess we could talk about what those policies might be.
Sure.
I want to talk about the violence bit for a minute because I'm curious why it is that violence wouldn't always be at the forefront. Why is it necessary for James Forman to criticize Michelle Alexander? How is it possible for Michelle Alexander to write a book about crime? It's not about crime. It's about incarceration and punishment and not call attention to violence. Why isn't violence more salient? Is it only lacking the salience amongst progressives or wouldn't the conservative law and order types be the first to point to violence as indicative of how the threat of society is unraveling? Is it a blaming the victim problem? Is it, I mean, I don't want to put words in your mouth, that the racial disparities are so stark that if you call attention to violence, it's very hard to avoid the question of why are black men so violent and so on. What do you think? This is on the violence question.
Yeah. So is the question, why is it that so-called progressives, liberals haven't taken violence seriously? Or is the question? Yeah.
That's the question. How is it that James Forman can come to actually contribute to the conversation by making the obvious observation that the rise of incarceration was a lot of things. And one of the things was it was a response to an increase in violence that most especially had its adverse effects in communities of color and low-income communities.
Yeah, I mean, it's a good sociology of science question. I don't know if I have a satisfying answer to this point. I remember from reading William Julius Wilson in graduate school that his argument in it was either the truly disadvantaged or when work disappears, that in the beginning, he's noting something very similar in the liberal scholarship on the quote unquote underclass well before Michelle Alexander. So it's something that is definitely not specific to Michelle Alexander. It's much, much broader and long running than that. This reluctance to take notice of what we would call maybe pathologies or different disparate rates across groups. I mean, my own opinion is that progressives and liberals do themselves a disservice by ignoring these facts. And we're going to get into this because I believe that progressives and liberals have a better explanation for it than people to their right. But as to why many progressives don't take notice, I don't know if I have a comprehensive answer beyond just noting that it's a longstanding fact of progressive scholarship.
Okay.
That's probably not satisfying.
But on the temporal question, the question of why we see a real shift in the qualitative, not just the trend, but a real break with the historical trend in the early 1970s that, you know, that ran its course. I mean, you start with, I don't know, 1980, 500,000 under lock and key. You end up at the turn of the 20th century, 21st century, with 2 million under lock and key.
Yeah.
It had a good long run, and it was a departure from the historical pattern, and you're attributing that mainly to a reaction to a historically unprecedented upsurge in violence. Am I right about that? Upsurge in violence that we see in the 60s unprecedented in American history?
Yeah, to be clear, I think that when I said that violence contributes, I think you summarized it well. The point was not that violence contributes mechanically, as in there are more people committing crimes, so there are more people in prison.
Yeah.
That is part of it, but a very small part of it. Really what happens is that violence contributes through what it does to politics, and there's a punitive reaction and a change in policy, and that is a large part of what explains the rise in incarceration. So as to the second question, has this ever happened in American history? To my knowledge, we don't really have very good data going back. It is true that there were, I've seen some scattered data sets on sort of early crime rates in early American cities, and they were quite high. But I know our modern data, the data that I have looked at, begins basically in the 60s, in the 70s, in the 80s. And even like good sub-state data is not even available until the 90s. So I think we don't know fully the answer to the second question that you asked. But we do know that in the period that we are concerned with here, which is in the period of the rise of incarceration, that rise in crime was historically unprecedented for sure, or unprecedented in that time period for sure.
Okay. So now what about the U.S. versus Northern Europe in terms of the extent of the footprint of the punitive state? Policing seems to be different in Germany or in France or in England than it is here in the U.S. Certainly the use of prisons is different. Sentences are shorter. They've got violent crime, although not as much violent crime as we have, but they've got a lot of property crime as well. Why is it that you're looking at an order of magnitude difference? You're looking at like 8-10 times as many people per capita under lock and key in the United States. Can we explain all of that by reference to the fact that there's no European-style welfare state here in the U.S., we don't have guaranteed health care or, you know, early retirements and 6 weeks of guaranteed vacation. I mean, I don't mean to be flippant.
No, not at all. Yeah.
What do you think is going on?
Yeah. I mean, the explanation that I would foreground when considering the cross-national issue is the one that I gave, which is that we handle social disorder very differently than these countries choose to handle social disorder. Part of the explanation for that, as you're saying, might well be that American levels of, or part of the cross-national difference might also be that the phenomenon that the punitive state is dealing with here is very different. It is definitely true that levels of lethal violence in the United States are an order of magnitude higher than in Europe and than in Western Europe. But those levels of violence might themselves be endogenous to the absence of a welfare state in the United States as well, right? But I think that's something that we'll come to discuss. I mean, the other rival explanation that we should tip our hat to is that the reason that public punitiveness becomes policy punitiveness in the United States and not elsewhere is because the public has voice over punitive, over criminal justice policy in the United States to an extent that is not true in other European countries, right? That's a common argument as well. But I think if that argument is to be correct, we need to understand public punitiveness. And that public punitiveness, it seems to me, is still a reaction to facts that, you know, the rise in violence and facts that the government could have done other things about to some extent. So in other words, the point that I'm trying to make is that, yes, it's true that the public has considerable voice over criminal justice policy in the United States, and that probably has something to do with policy punitiveness, but that is not a sufficient explanation for American mass incarceration, because it still leaves open the question of why there are these enormously high levels of violence and violent crime in the United States.
Okay, good. And I just want to underscore something about the contrast between the European social democratic societies and the U.S. having to do with the degree of voice or influence that public has over criminal justice policy. Or the flip side of that is the lack of deference and delegation to experts.
Experts.
You know, so we elect judges, we elect prosecutors. We don't defer when the commission tells us that the sentence should only be 3 years and not 30 years. It ends up being, if there's a passionate demand for more years in prison, it's going to be closer to 30 than it's going to be 3 in the United States, no matter what the experts might say, this kind of idea. I think does David Garland make this argument in The Culture of Control? I know.
Certainly, yeah. And he has a book on the death penalty, which makes this argument as well.
Aha. That the reason that we still have a death penalty in the U.S. and you don't see it in Germany or whatever is that there's much more of a mass, as it were, small d, democratic governance.
Roughly, yeah, definitely.
Here in the United States of criminal justice policy. And that raises some really interesting kind of questions about agency and delegation and hierarchy. And, you know, if you have normative concerns, do you want to always
Absolutely.
Have the masses pushing things around? The founding fathers understood that the masses are subject to passions and to demagoguery and to being riled up and try to protect us from that a little bit in the U.S. Constitution. Anyway,
when I taught this issue to my students this semester, this was a source of great consternation. This issue about how we understand the relationship between procedural democracy, obeying democratic process, but also obviously they all have their vision of what justice ought to be, and for none of them did it involve the death penalty. So this was actually a class debate that we had a few weeks into the semester, because this was challenging them.
Yeah, but it turns out they are not the median voter in any jurisdiction in the United States.
No, they are not.
Our students here at Brown are all unanimous on the death penalty, but it turns out that the typical voter in Nebraska has a very different view.
Yeah.
Okay, so what about the class and racial disparity? That's another thing that is characteristic of our... let me summarize if I understand. Okay, so why did it happen in the U.S. and when it happened? And has largely to do with the rise in violence and fears of violence and people's reaction to those fears. Why is the U.S. so different from other democratic capitalist societies, wealthy societies in Northern Europe and so forth? Well, in part because the structure of social provision, broadly speaking, is much less generous here in the United States than in these other places. In part because the way in which decisions end up getting made about crime and punishment here in the United States are much more subject to populist and popular sentiment than would be the case in Northern Europe. Then finally, why is it that when we look at the complexion, pun intended, or, you know, double entendre intended, when we look at the characteristics of the population who are most adversely affected by the rise of incarceration, we find that it's people of color. And we find that it's people of a social disadvantage. Perhaps there's no surprise in that. On the other hand, you might think that the fact that the burden of more punitiveness falls so disproportionately on people who are themselves so disadvantaged might serve to mitigate might push in the other direction from the populist sentiment for more punitiveness. It might say, yes, more punitive, but when we say who, people might stand back and say, oh, but in a way we're balancing our cultural budget on the backs of the least of us, you know, and be given some pause before, they say three strikes and you're out, because who's going to get struck out here? Certainly not the son of, a doctor, lawyer, or, you know, a business person. So anyway, what do you think about that?
Yeah, so what explains racial disparities? I think there's obviously a, again, quote-unquote conventional narrative, which is that the reason for racial disparities in both exposure to police violence and also, in particular, let's consider incarceration rates, that that's explained by implicit or explicit bias at one or another stage of the criminal justice process. I think that our best evidence suggests that if that's a explanation, it's a minor explanation of the outcome. And actually, most of the racial disparity in incarceration rates is explained by racial disparities in criminal offending. And the best evidence that we have for that is from a comprehensive analysis by Becken Bloomstein in a recent issue of the Journal of Quantitative Criminology, where they compare both you can get sort of estimates of racial disparities in crime commission from victimization surveys. They compare that to arrest ratios, and then they compare those arrest ratios to incarceration rate disparities. And they show that about 70 to 80% of the disparity overall in racial, in incarceration rates can be explained by disparities in criminal offending. So that's to say that I'm sure that explicit and implicit, nobody who lives in America would be surprised to know that explicit and implicit bias probably play some role, but they play less of a role than the input disparities in criminal offending. So that would be the proximate explanation for racial disparities in incarceration. Of course, then we have to ask what explains racial disparities in criminal offending. And I think that would be, maybe, I mean, should
well,
we do that?
Let's get to that. But wait, I want to just pause for a moment because you're saying something noteworthy. And there's going to be some quibbling. The noteworthy thing that you're saying is that Michelle Alexander is wrong. I'm sorry, I don't, again, want to put words in your mouth. This is what I'm hearing. You can correct me. That this is not the new Jim Crow, at least not conventionally understood, because, well, why is mass incarceration dragging into its net so many persons of color? Mainly, 80-20, mainly because they're acting in ways that end up having them apprehended and then duly prosecuted, convicted, and punished for the actions that they've undertaken. They've committed crimes and they're being punished for the crimes that they've committed. That largely accounts for the difference between the representation of blacks and whites in prison, 80-20. You're saying that. And therefore, mass incarceration might be many things. It might be a blight on the society. Again, these are my words and I want you to correct me. I don't want to attribute views to you that you don't hold.
Yeah.
It might be a blight on the society. It might be immoral. It might be historically immoral. But it is not in a straightforward way, the new Jim Crow. It is not simply a recitation of America's narrative going way, way back, which is that black people are inferior. They're fit for punishment. Let's find ways of dragging them into it. They're doing things that lead to them getting into prison. And moreover, and again, you didn't say this, but you can correct me, they're doing them mainly to other black people. So
yeah,
now we have a hard problem, not an easy problem. The problem before was really very easy. It was just anti-Jim Crow 101. I mean, we're against racism.
Yeah.
Now we got a much, much harder problem.
Absolutely. No, I think in some ways, I understand that people hear what I just said or what you just said and associate it with, let's say, not so woke or not so radical take on the present. But in many ways, I think actually it's the opposite. I think that what this analysis suggests to me, or what this diagnosis suggests to me, is that the problem of American mass incarceration, the problem of addressing American mass incarceration, is so much more complicated than putting black faces in certain positions of power, reducing implicit bias, having cultural sensitivity trainings. It's so much more complicated and ingrained than that. That would actually do very little to change the racial disparities. And so we have to attack those racial disparities at their root, is the position that I would take.
Okay.
And maybe we should talk about what that root entails? Because I think maybe there you and I would differ a little bit. I'm not sure.
No, we probably would. I think we know that because we rehearsed this conversation at a Brown University commencement forum at the end of May, and those distinctions came out. Let me sort of frame that. That's exactly where I want to go in the following way.
Yeah.
So here's a Trump voter. I'm not a Trump voter. I want everyone out there in the world to know I did not vote for Donald Trump. I have no intention of doing so. But here's a Trump voter. I can, you know, suspend disbelief or whatever and try to imagine what somebody is thinking. Here's what they're thinking. You just said that the black people are committing the crimes. You just told me that it's not about biased courts and 100-to-1 cocaine crack versus powder disparity. I mean, those are things, and they may be bad, but it's not about that. It's mainly 80-20 is what you said, Professor Usmani. 80-20 is what you said on the disparity, mostly about offending. Therefore, why shouldn't we lock these people up? We got laws. They choose to break them. I don't understand what the problem is here. They're hurting people. We want that to stop. We want these THUGs. I dare not say the word because I don't want to be caught on tape saying the word, even if it were in context. No, man, people are getting very upset about the word. They don't want you to use the word because they think it's like N-I-G-G-E-R. They think it's a similar kind of word. But here's what the Trump voter is saying in suburban St. Louis or Baltimore or whatever. They're saying, you just got to telling me that they're, have you looked at the murder rates, the homicide rates? Half the homicides in this country are black men committed against other black men. If it's 40%, then correct me, okay? 40% when they're like 8% of the population or whatever. And so therefore we're locking them up. I fail to see what the problem is there.
Yeah, so I think, I mean, that's the challenge. Of course, that's the conservative challenge. And I think that my response to that would be that that argument, what I would associate with the conservative approach to the problem of criminal offending, doesn't really take the analytical task of explaining crime very seriously at all. I mean, crime, much like incarceration, the incarceration rate disparity is an important research question that deserves explanation. So is the disparity in rates of criminal offending. And I have an explanation that, in my opinion, is correct about why different groups have different rates of criminal offending. And that explanation, I mean, and we'll talk about this in a second, that explanation doesn't exonerate people of moral responsibility, but it severely moderates the extent to which you can hold people morally responsible for these things that we're talking about as bad choices, simply bad choices that they make. So my explanation for that, concretely, rather than talking about the meta explanation, let me talk about the explanation. My explanation is that, you know, African Americans live at the lowest reaches of the American class structure disproportionately, and they live in neighborhoods of concentrated poverty where institutions have collapsed and schools are awful. And so to this Trump voter, I would reply, why is it any surprise to you that when you put people in communities that have degenerated to the extent that those communities have, and when you put people in those kinds of situations, why is it any surprise to you that there are these disparate rates of offending?
Okay.
Maybe you could ventriloquize the Trump reply.
I know exactly what they're going to say. They're going to say, wait a minute, the proportion of the California state population that is Asian is 22%. I made the number up, but it's a number. It's a number, and it's probably not that far off. 18%, whatever. The proportion of the California incarcerated population that is Asian is 2%. Again, I make the number up. We can look up the number. It's going to be a number like that. Mm-hmm. They're going to say poverty does not force somebody to do something violent against their fellow human being or to rob somebody of their property. Poverty still leaves people with choices. And otherwise, because you don't think there are any poor Asians? There are. But they're not going around committing violent crimes at the same rate as the African Americans are committing them. They're going to say, in the same community from which have come the people that we are incarcerating for duly prosecuted and convicted acts that they committed against society, in that same community, There are brothers and cousins who didn't do those acts. Not everybody in a poor community becomes a violent criminal or becomes a criminal of any kind.
In fact, most do not.
Most do not. Don't you dishonor the choices? You say they don't have choices? So the people who, what did they do? Stumbled into sobriety and stumbled into a conformity with a social norm don't deserve any credit for having so stumbled? They resisted the inexorable, historically deterministic force of poverty? Come on. You rob those people of any agency and of any dignity at the end of the day, they're going to say. In fact, you don't even have to be a Trump voter to say that. I'm saying it.
Yeah, I mean, no, I of course I understand that position. But the fact that most poor people are not criminals, which is absolutely true. Most poor people, most people who live in poverty, most people who live in awful neighborhoods do not turn out to offend. That doesn't imply that criminals should be considered agents who freely will their criminality. That's the position that I've never really understood. I don't know how that follows. A good analogy would be the relationship between smoking and lung cancer, right? We know that most smokers actually don't end up contracting lung cancer. It's only a minority of smokers who contract lung cancer. But how absurd would it be, Glenn, to say that there's no role for smoking in our explanation of why any given individual who contracts lung cancer contracted lung cancer? Of course there's a causal role, and of course it should affect policy, and of course it should affect, then, in this context, the way we think about moral responsibility. It doesn't, to me, make any sense to hold people who've lived in these kinds of circumstances morally responsible in the way that you would hold anybody else who hadn't lived in those circumstances morally responsible for doing the same thing. So let me put a slightly finer point on it. I grew up with a silver spoon in my mouth. I went to international schools, then I was sent to I moved around as a kid, went to many different international schools, then I was sent to prep school in the United States. In all of these contexts, I've known many people who've made many stupid, bad choices. But the punishment for those stupid, bad choices in those contexts was always a second chance, a third chance, resources lavished on you, which is exactly the way that we should deal with bad choices that people make.
Let me stop you because you got two arguments going. One of them is they didn't have a choice, and the other one is they had a choice, but the consequences of bad choices were different. And I want to make those arguments.
The first argument is a stronger argument, which is kind of a hard determinist argument. Well, and I don't think I'm going to. So let's go with the second argument. That's the argument that I would prefer to go with right now.
I want to deal with both of them, and I want to speak to the first one because I like your, smoking causes cancer. Not everybody who smokes gets cancer. Poverty causes crime, but not everybody who is poor is a criminal. Those things are perfect. That's a nice little analogy there. I like that. And underlying this, smoking causes cancer, but not everyone gets it, is the idea that individuals vary with respect to their susceptibility to have the process that ends up being a cancer triggered by the environmental influence of the nicotine and whatever is in smoking.
No doubt.
People differ in that respect. They're differentially susceptible. But in a population, if I introduce smoking, I'm bound to get more cancers, even though not everybody's going to get it. And so someone who comes along and said, you see, smoking didn't cause cancer because look here, here's someone who smoked and they didn't get it. That's a fallacy, okay? And you're trying to import that model into a discussion about crime as if to say that, well, poverty creates the susceptibility to engaging in a set of behaviors. Not everyone engages in those behaviors, but I don't infer from the fact that not everyone who is influenced by the stimulus ends up exhibiting the behavior. I don't infer from that the stimulus has not caused the behavior. Neither do I infer that there's any such thing as, quote, free will that's being exercised by those subject to the stimulus who did not exhibit the behavior. They simply were not as susceptible as those who did exhibit the behavior. Is that a fair?
That's a fair summary, with the exception of the very last point, which is that someone might respond to say that it's precisely one's susceptibility to that circumstance that is free will, right? So you could have some account of susceptibility that's not a free will-based account, or you could have an account of that susceptibility that's about choice. Right. But I'm saying even in the case where your account of that susceptibility is about choice, you have to admit that the fact that these circumstances are causally relevant to the outcome in the case of individuals who suffer, who don't make good choices, quote unquote, means that you have to moderate your account of moral responsibility. Because there are other people who aren't subject to those circumstances who make equivalently bad choices who don't suffer the awful.
Okay, that's the second argument. That's the second
argument. Yeah, they're slightly different arguments. Argument.
I think the second argument is stronger for the reasons I think that you're inferring, which is there's a fundamental unfairness in the situation in which we have, and perhaps we shouldn't have done, but we have, decided to punish people for their choices. And then we don't mete out that punishment in anything like an equal manner to people, all of whom have made that choice. The ones who can afford lawyers or rehab programs or can transfer to another school.
Absolutely.
Do not suffer the consequences of the one who has to go to the juvenile detention facility.
And so in effect, you're punishing people not just for their bad choices, but also for their bad circumstances, which seems to me totally immoral.
Yeah, so in response to the second, I think the second is a stronger argument, but I think the first is much more fundamental. In response to the second, the remedy, it would seem to me, would be let's make sure that everybody has, having made a bad choice and being susceptible or subject to punishment, an equal standing in the process that ends up then destroying people's lives. Let's not let somebody who happens to have a dad with a PhD get out of jail free card relative to somebody who doesn't know who his dad is because he split, you know, when the kid was 6 months old. We can solve that problem by making sure that people have good legal defense when they go into court, by making sure that treatment for addiction is available to everybody regardless of whether or not they can pay, and a variety of other ways. We won't completely solve it because nepotism, favoritism, networks in which people can exert the influence. I mean, I'm about to have surgery. I have a good friend who asked me, who's going to do it? I said, oh, well, the doc who's over here. My friend says, well, he's not the best doc in the world. I said, true, but he's a pretty good doc. He said, well, you should get the best doc in the world. I said, everybody can't have the best doc in the world. There's like 6 billion people. How many of the best docs in the world are there? He says, but you're Glenn Lowry. You should have the best doc in the world. And I thought, well, yeah, probably I'm Glenn Lowry. I should have the best doc in the world. But then I thought, how unfair is that? After all, I got a pretty good doc. I mean, it's not like I'm going to, you know, a fly-by-night. And, I mean, spending a whole lot of time crowding somebody else out because I can make a phone call to somebody and get on the docket of the best doc in the world. Something fundamentally immoral about that to me. So I get that. I get that. But I want to go back to this choice thing because I think a couple of things. One of the things I think is we need to assume that people have choices even if they don't in some meta social scientific causal universe have them because society is not going to work unless we assume that people have choices. That will lead to injustice in the occasions in which people don't have the choice. So, for example, a domestic abuser. Somebody who drinks and then beats up their spouse. Someone who rapes. That offender undoubtedly has a story. I mean, you could, in many of those instances, undoubtedly give an account, maybe even a compelling account, about how the bad actor was subject to environmental and historical influences that were overpowering. In that situation. And yet, given that in a complex social system where these acts, you know, or violence within the domestic relationships or sexual assault are occurring, and given the need for the equality, in this case of women who might be susceptible to these criminal offenses, and a kind of public recognition of the dignity of those persons and of the tragic and unacceptable character of the offense, we have to treat the people who do those things, even though there is undoubtedly a story, as having made a choice for which we're holding them accountable. And moreover, we have to review with suspicion anyone who would come along and try to excuse their, and I know you're not, I don't mean to put that on you, you're not trying to excuse bad behavior, but anyone who would say, let us not punish this person, let us not judge this person, let us understand that this person's actions have been determined by forces that were beyond their control. we'd have to view with suspicion anyone who's making that argument, because that argument is not just a policy argument. It's a profoundly moral argument about whether the society has the right to establish boundaries and lay down markers and affirm principles. And one of the ways that we do that is through the way in which we deal with people who violate those principles and cross those boundaries, even though the actions that they undertake to end up in that position may have been determined by other things. We have to judge people when they kill somebody and leave them bleeding out on the street of a city's mean streets. We have to, I don't say death penalty, but I say we have to deal with them harshly. We have to deal with them with the embodying the same degree of violation that the person who was the family of the person who was victimized would feel, don't we?
No, I don't think so, exactly. I mean, I don't disagree with everything that you've said, but there is a philosophical difference here, which is that I think when you've been making the argument that we need to punish somebody and hold them morally accountable for what they've done, you've been adverting to the badness of the thing that they've done. And I don't really think that that follows exactly. I mean, you could take the example of somebody who is mentally ill and definitely not in control of their actions, and they could do something awful, but I think you and I would both agree that it wouldn't make sense to hold them morally responsible for doing that awful thing. So moral responsibility has to come from somewhere else, not from the awfulness of the thing that they've done, but from some assessment of whether or not they were morally free to do what they did. And that's where I think the points that I'm trying to make are important, which is that we have to moderate the amount of moral responsibility that we associate with people who do heinous things all the time, because the vast majority of them come from these awful, impoverished backgrounds. I mean, there was a statistic from Bruce Western's recent study, which you might have seen. It was in the New York Times, where Bruce Western's study is a study of people who have a random sample of people who left Massachusetts state prisons. And the statistic that stood out, that they wrote a whole article about in the New York Times, was the fact that 42% of his representative sample reported having seen someone killed in their childhood,
yes,
right? That they lived lives in effect of extreme violence. And so given that traumatic childhood, you would expect then a reasonable account of their moral responsibility to be different than an account of the moral responsibility of someone who didn't live that traumatic childhood. And that's mainly the point that I'm making to you, is that then philosophically, when we're thinking about why a society ought to punish these people, perhaps to some extent, yes, they've made bad choices, so we hold them morally accountable for those choices. That's not a position that I would commit to, but I agree with you that that is generally the modal position in the United States. But I think we also then need to think about other reasons. You know, it's not the case that if we don't have recourse to their moral responsibility, we can't punish them, which is kind of the caricature that you're constructing in some of your remark. I mean, sorry, that sounded a bit harsher than I meant it to.
It was harsh, but I could take it, man.
The idea, I think people think that if we aren't able to hold people morally responsible, then there's no grounds for punishment. And I think that doesn't follow. There are other grounds for punishment other than holding people morally responsible for their choices. There's the public health justification for punishment. The reason that we punish is to protect other people and to then help the person recover.
Yeah, deterrence and incapacitation. That's what they said in the criminology textbook that I read.
Right.
You give an incentive signal to people, don't do this or there will be consequences, and you keep the bad actors who may be harmed by society from being able to harm others in virtue of that by taking them out of society. But I hear you. I mean, let me distinguish between, I mean, I think there's a spectrum here. If someone is holding a gun to someone's head and they say, rape that woman or I'll blow your brains out, and the person goes and rapes under the gun, obviously they're not morally responsible. If someone has a severe mental illness and they're not able to tell the difference between right and wrong or even to tie their shoelaces in the morning without help, well, we're going to judge, but we're not going to hold them morally responsible. And in virtue of not holding them morally responsible, we're not going to lock them up for life. We may send them to treatment for life or until such time as they're better, but we're going to treat them differently. And if someone is, seen, you know, 42%, I saw that number from Bruce. In fact, I used to have a beer with Bruce Western, the sociologist, every Saturday over at, Murphy's Pub in Brookline, which was a Goose's an Australian brother.
And once on Blogging Heads, I believe, right?
Yeah, we once had a beer conversation on Blogging Heads. Bruce appreciates a good brew, and we had the habit, my friend Bruce Weston and I. And while he was interviewing these guys coming out of prison, he was telling me about their stories, because he did a lot of extensive face-to-face interview work with this sample. This number, about 42%, has seen a murder. Imagine that. I mean, how many human beings have seen someone killed in front of themselves? Not many, I would say. 42% of these guys, you were led to think seeing someone murdered in front of you actually has a traumatic effect on you that might lead to you to behave in ways that end up getting you incarcerated. I get that. But I want to create a spectrum. Gun to the head, mental illness, someone who was under the influence of drugs, now they chose to take the drugs. So you might, but then they're an addict, so maybe they didn't choose to take the drugs. So you're going to have different degrees of moral responsibility. Poverty, grew up in a single family home, no father present. Maybe I shouldn't even mention that. Maybe the feminists will get mad at me. It depends on your ideology. But you see, there would be a spectrum. Where I draw the line of withholding versus enforcing public judgment and moral responsibility becomes a judgmental question. There got to be a line somewhere because everybody has a story. So you're on a slippery slope, is what I'm saying. You need a principle to discriminate between circumstances in which the imputation of moral responsibility is unwarranted in virtue of the deterministic influences of whatever, and those where it is not. I don't see that principle anywhere in sight in anything that you're saying. And if there is no principle, it seems to me we're going to slide all the way down at the end of the day to everybody's got a story.
Yeah, no, it's a very good point. I think so. I would have to say two things. In truth, I agree with you that this is a slippery slope, and in fact, we slide all the way to hard determinism. I do fundamentally agree with that, actually. But I want to try and resist that for a second, because I don't think that's a convincing position, and I accept that that's not a convincing position. What I would say, if we don't accept the hard determinist slide, what I would say is that I don't exactly understand why we need to think about moral responsibility as a binary condition, that people either exercise full moral responsibility or they exercise no moral responsibility whatsoever. To me, it seems, as you just yourself outlined, that it's a continuum, that people exercise varying degrees of moral responsibility, all of which, as long as they're not all the way at the free agent end of the spectrum, all of which moderate society's thirst for retribution, for punishing them. It means that we have to moderate the amount of moral responsibility that we accord to them when we think about how to punish them and why we punish them. Does that satisfy?
It moves in the direction. I mean, I worry now about sentencing that's conditioned on a sociologist or a social worker's report. How bad was the background of this kid, asked the judge. Oh, I have 3 to 7 years. That's the span that I've been given by the Sentencing Commission. 3 years for him because it was very bad. Then for the other one who comes in, he's a white middle-class kid, a black middle-class kid for that matter. Parents, two professionals with college degrees, grew up in a leafy green suburb, and he did the thing that he did. Oh, well, he's got to get the full 7 years. I worry about that.
And you're right to worry about that.
Yeah.
But at the same time, a society which doesn't take those facts into account, it would seem to us, would be an unjust society. A society which didn't take into account the circumstances that moderated an agent's responsibility, that would be a bad society, it seems to me.
Okay, I'm going to just leave that there. I'm not sure I agree, but I think it's something really worth considering. So I'm still thinking about it from when you first put that argument to me a few weeks ago. But I want to ask you something else, which is, so you think a more expansive welfare state, housing for families that Matthew Desmond in his brilliant book Evicted describes for us in Milwaukee being kicked out, and the trauma on those families when the sheriff comes and, you know, evicts them from the apartment, and the moving company puts their things on the sidewalk, and the little kid who used to have a room to play in is now outdoors. He's in a homeless shelter somewhere and whatever. We should have better housing. Healthcare, you know, you're a drug addict. You literally know you have a problem. You want to do something about it, but man, they want $500 a day at the treatment center and you don't have it. Jobs, employment, education, we spend a pittance on it. We should be spending twice as much per pupil for the education of kids who are coming from the most disadvantaged communities and homes and give them a decent chance. Instead, we pat our back on spending 90% as much with et cetera, et cetera. Income for families. Here's an impoverished thing. Maybe there should be a universal basic income. We're a wealthy society, et cetera. You really think, I tip my hand here a bit, that if we were to go Norway or Sweden or Denmark, all would be well in the ghetto? People wouldn't be getting, there wouldn't be gangs riding around with, you know, settling beasts by firing their automatic weapons out of windows and killing innocent people. There wouldn't be, et cetera, et cetera. I could go on, but I don't want to because we're at the end of the hour. You really think that? I mean,
the short answer? The short answer is yes.
Well, I know the short answer is yes.
The short answer is yes, I suppose. Is the issue.
Justify that.
Justify that. I mean,
yeah.
So.
What's the
evidence? Of course I don't think that if you were to expand the earned income tax credit tomorrow, all the problem of lethal violence would be solved by day after tomorrow. That's not my position.
The Glenn Lowry, Glenn Show with Adana Usmani. We had a very good conversation that got disrupted. So here, now we're back. So we're back. Forgive the disruption. I had put a question to Adana. How could he possibly think that a European-style social welfare state was going to deal with all the problems of crime and violence and low-income in communities of color in America? And he was answering before we lost connection. So I'm giving you the last word. I promise not to try to rebut anything you say.
Yeah, so no. So do I believe that if tomorrow we were to expand the social welfare safety net in the United States, that day after tomorrow crime would disappear? No, I don't believe that, and I don't think that's a serious position. But do I think that if every child who grew up in the South Bronx or on the south side of Chicago was to have instead grown up in Greenwich, Connecticut or Fairfax County or something like that, that the crime and violence in the United States would look very different? Yes, I do believe that, and I really think that ultimately the task of expanding social democracy or the welfare state in the United States is really that task. It's the task of turning the South Side into Greenwich, Connecticut. That's the kind of task that we have to set ourselves. And yeah, I believe in that kind of United States, we wouldn't deal with these outlying levels of violence. We would deal with crime and we would deal with disorder for sure, but not with the level of lethal violence that we see in the United States. Not at all. That's my wager to you.
This is not a rebuttal. This is a follow-up.
Okay.
Programs like food stamps, and I'm not being pejorative, I'm not being derogatory, I'm just trying to be descriptive. Temporary assistance to needy families, the earned income tax credit, Medicaid, do you think they can, in fact, turn some parts of the South Side of Chicago? That's where I grew up, by the way. And, you know, not all of the South Side of Chicago is a blighted, you know, impoverished, you know, no man's land of violence and desperation. Some of it is strong families trying to raise their children and their grandchildren and keep their lawns mowed and their flower beds watered. That's the kind of community that I grew up in on the South Side of Chicago. But in any case, you think that food stamps and Medicaid and TANF and earned income tax credit and so forth can turn the South Side of Chicago into Greenwich, Connecticut? Some people would say, gosh, there's a lot going on in Greenwich that doesn't have to do with how much of a paycheck is coming over the, you know, over the wire. A lot of it has to do with the strength of families and the values that they affirm and stuff like that. I ain't trying to provoke a fight with anybody. I'm just trying to tell you what just trying to tell you what your Trump voter is saying out there. So can you expand on that just a bit before we close out? Because you were going to have the last word, and I just had to ask you that.
Yeah, I was obviously being a bit facetious. I don't mean that we would literally turn these communities into one percenter communities. I don't think that's true. But I think that if you were to think seriously about the deficits in these communities, and maybe for your Trump voter, there are cultural deficits. If you're to think seriously about addressing those deficits, there's no way to address those deficits except by giving those communities resources. Even if you believe that those deficits are primarily cultural rather than structural, the only way to intervene is by giving resources to the poor that they don't today have. Yeah, I strongly do believe that. I can't think of another way in which you would intervene to shape norms differently or shape institutions differently or shape opportunities differently. I mean, I don't really know what your Trump voter envisions for and as a successful policy intervention. Is it haranguing these communities? Is it saying that they should have different ideas than the ideas that they currently have in their head? The only levers for policy are resources, and that's the only thing that we can do. And I do believe that we would fundamentally transform these communities if we were to commit much more to them than the stingy United States does commit to them.
Okay. I don't have a response. First of all, it's a hopeful vision. I do have a response. It's a very hopeful vision. And it calls us to higher ground. It exposes the inadequacy of certain prototypical reactions, which is, why aren't they better? Why don't they have different values? Why don't they work hard? Don't they know they're in America? After all, my grandparents came from wherever they came from, and they had to deal with whatever they had to deal with, and they didn't resort to... I mean, in a way, you respond to that, and I think you do so effectively. I think it's a heavy lift, not just the politically heavy lift because there are a lot of Trump voters out there, but I think it's a policy heavy lift.
Of course it is. Of course it is.
But the point is, we shouldn't, I think a point could be, and maybe your point, that's no good reason to give up. In fact, we're compelled, if we're decent, to look, and if that doesn't work, to look again and to look yet again, to try to stay engaged with these communities and to try to make them more Greenwich, Connecticut-like. Because every kid that comes into the world deserves better than what some of these kids are getting.
Absolutely.
All I can do is say right on to that. So forgive my skepticism, but, you know, that's my job, okay? Thanks a lot.
Thank you very much for having me. I really enjoyed it.
You're welcome. I did it too.
Thanks a lot.
So take care.
Bye-bye. See you. Bye. So,